Well, wait till you hear this next segment that Linda has, especially, and pay very close attention to what you hear about Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR. Amazing. We'll be back. Okay, welcome back. Linda Moulton Howe with us. Linda, I think this is the segment that everybody's going to just go nuts over. Go ahead.
Well, it's all extraordinary. And in a 2012 article entitled Truman Was the FDR's Exit Plan, writer John Stanchak wrote, this is a quote, Franklin D. Roosevelt was going to win the election of 1944. That much was certain. FDR was an icon, a victor over the Depression, a champion of the middle class, a stalwart leader against the Axis powers in World War II. FDR, though, was crumbling physically, and there was nothing 1940s medical technology could do for him. FDR pressured younger, robustly healthy Senator Harry S. Truman of Missouri to be his running mate. And it took a phone call from FDR on the eve of the Democratic Convention to change Truman's mind. And this would be FDR's fourth unprecedented term as U.S. president. Author Paul Smith thinks behind the scenes, FDR wanted Truman because they both knew the great secrets of extraterrestrial beings and craft, and they were both Freemasons. FDR, General George Marshall, Harry S. Truman, and others had allegedly shared secrets about the April 12, 1941 Cape Girardeau crash, and only a few months later, in the early morning of February 25, 1942, they all were assumed to have talked about the Battle of Los Angeles. This was where we launched 37th Coast Artillery Brigade firing of 1,430 anti-aircraft shells at a diamond-shaped craft of unknown origin.
And they could hear it ping when they shot things in.
That's right, exactly. It was glowing. They could hear sound. And it was above the Santa Monica Mountains, and there was also something above San Bernardino. And the question is, in that whole period, had each of those powerful men gone down into a sub-basement underneath the Capitol and stared at the three gray aliens in the three jars? Then 2 years later, in 1944, after FDR had won the re-election for the unprecedented fourth presidential term, how closely was FDR talking with his Vice President Truman and Chief of the Army George Marshall and others sworn to secrecy about the alien presence? Harry Truman would be Vice President for only 82 days. On April 12, 1945, the news of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's death was announced throughout the United States in theaters, schools, on the radio, and spread rapidly in Manhattan's Times Square. The New York Times wrote the next day, quote, in home communities, Brooklyn, the Bronx, Harlem, Queens, women left their dinners on the stoves to stand in neighborhood groups, passing the word or discussing it with bated breath. Groups, small at first and ever-growing, assembled in silence wherever a shopkeeper had turned his radio speaker toward the street, close quote. Truman told reporters how the news of FDR's death hit him, quote, I felt like the moon, the stars, and all the planets had fallen on me. If you ever pray, pray for me now, close quote. The public was told the cause of FDR's death was cerebral hemorrhage. But author Paul Smith found in his new book research that there are many reasons to consider a different truth, that President Roosevelt put a gun to his head and pulled the trigger. First, Paul and I pick up again with the Cape Girardeau UFO crash history that was followed by the UFOs over Los Angeles 10 months later and the correspondence between FDR and General Marshall.
FDR, Truman, George Marshall, Vannevar Bush, all of them knew about alien beings and extraterrestrial technology by April 12, 1941.
That's correct. And in one of FDR memos, he mentioned, we need to restrict this information. It was something you didn't talk about, and barely behind closed doors and with certain right people. You didn't talk about it, certainly with the press or the public. I'll give you a small example. There's a story of a man named Philip Reynolds who came forward in 2012. His grandfather was Mr. Walter Reynolds, a Cape Girardeau fireman. On his deathbed, Walter had cancer. He apparently confessed that not only is Pastor Huffman's story true, he said, I ought to know, I was there fighting the flames, saw the bodies, I peeked into the spaceship too, and that he picked up some of the crash debris. The Army caught him trying to pocket it, and they forced him to turn it over, booted him from the crash site, and in the aftermath, he felt that he was being watched, spied on around town, and that his telephone was tapped.
It was not too long after, just a few months, that in February of 1942, the Los Angeles Times carried a story of American artillery shooting at what appears in a photograph to be a glowing diamond over the Santa Monica Mountains. It's referred to as the Battle of LA. And our government tried to get away with explaining that they were shooting at what they thought was an invasion from Japan following what had happened in Hawaii only a month and a half before.
Right.
But we now have documents between George Marshall, the Secretary of War, and FDR referring to celestial vehicles, bringing down two celestial vehicles, one in San Bernardino and one in the Santa Monica Mountains. That would have been then not long after the Cape Girardeau revelation.
That's correct. President Roosevelt relied so heavily on George Marshall, and we have a 42 memo that was leaked around the year 2000 discussing the application of this non-terrestrial know-how in atomic energy and how it should be used to perfect a super weapon of war. FDR was burning with rage after Pearl Harbor, and he wanted something done, anything that would give us an advantage over the Nazis and the Japanese Imperial Army. He wrote to General Marshall, finding practical uses for the atomic secrets learned from the study of celestial devices. It is important for exploring further application in this new wonder. And in a 1944 memorandum to Dr. Vannevar Bush's Non-Terrestrial Science and Technology Committee, Roosevelt emphasized again the application of non-terrestrial know-how in atomic energy must be used in perfecting our super weapons of war. We must take advantage of such wonders that have come to us. And I congratulate you on coming to grips with the reality that our planet is not the only one harboring intelligent life in the universe.
Why do you think that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, his Vice President Harry S. Truman, his advisor Vannevar Bush, and others, why would they have immediately wanted to keep this a secret from the American public in a government that is supposed to be of, by, and for the people?
It boils down to secrecy at all costs is often the motto of the Army intelligence. So it was best to avoid a panic at all costs and just cover things up until at least we knew what was going on. And I think that happened first in Cape Girardeau, and that was the policy going forward probably to this day.
Have you ever had anybody talk about a threat, an unfriendly non-human among the many that seem to be interacting with this planet?
No, I don't believe I've read of anyone in a condition of fear or feeling that we were going to be invaded, that we were being threatened. People in government apparently were satisfied that these creatures were of a scientific nature, observing us without getting involved, and it was just purely an accident that they crashed near Missouri and Roswell, New Mexico, 6 years later. We are not being represented well, are we, by our government or people in power within the military who know the answers to these secrets, and they're not serving us with the truth. It seems apparent that Dr. Vannevar Bush began examining the craft and found atomic propulsion system, neutronic in nature, and thought, we can possibly apply this to our atomic bomb program. And from there, boy, secrecy came down hard and fast. It was a race to see who could perfect the atomic bomb, and America very much wanted to win, especially after we were attacked in December of 41, and things looked very bad in 41 and 42 for this country. We had to develop our nuclear weapon program and outrace the Germans and the Japanese, and when they applied all of this atomic know-how from the alien crash, that really led to what Dr. Otto Krauss called in 1962 a subject that is more top secret than the atom bomb itself. He said this in a test of the atom bomb in Nevada in 62. Someone asked how we could have such advanced atom bomb weaponry. He replied, there was a crash in the Ozarks. When asked to clarify, he said, oh, it was a UFO that crashed in Missouri in 1941. This was an eminent physicist who knew what was going on. He said, at that time, this is a secret considered even more top secret than the atom bomb itself.
In 2016, what is your own personal perspective on this strict policy of denial and lies since World War II and Cape Girardeau, keeping from the American people the truth that we're not alone in this universe, never have been, and that our government has been back engineering extraterrestrial technology and keeping it all from us?
I would like to see information finally admitted to. They can do what is called in the CIA a limited hangout in which they reveal some things but not everything. It's not necessary anymore, in my opinion, to keep these secrets from the American public. The basic fact that we are being observed and a few of these creatures have crashed on American soil and that they do not represent a threat to us, but we can only count on our democratic form of government in America to hopefully give us the truth someday.
As you write about the controversy over the death of FDR, that ever since the April 12, 1945 announcement that FDR had died of a cerebral hemorrhage, dozens of people have leaked that it wasn't just a hemorrhage, that he had asked for a gun and shot himself in the head.
He may have made the decision to take himself out to end his misery. Roosevelt was a devout Freemason, and Masons always show up at the funeral of a fellow member to perform services, but they did not in FDR's case, not at the White House and not at Hyde Park. Very, very suspicious that, once again, Masons will not show up if you commit suicide. We're talking about 1944. Franklin Roosevelt left the White House with only a handful of aides and convalesced in South Carolina at a private estate by the seashore. His secretary recorded in her diary at that time her great surprise that the president asked seriously that a loaded handgun be brought to him. Now, he made it through that period of time. It was very difficult for his health, but obviously he had a loaded gun on his mind. And a year later, he made it up to April of 45, the four-year anniversary of the Cape Girardeau UFO crash. He separated himself from the White House and almost all of his assistants and all of his family and traveled to Georgia, where only a couple of secretaries and a couple of aides came with him. He spent almost 2 weeks in Warm Springs at what was called the Little White House when he apparently, allegedly, pulled out a loaded gun from his lap robe and ended his life, knowing that he was probably dying anyway. It was the exact four-year anniversary date of the Mo 41 crash, and it made the new president, Harry Truman of Missouri. And Truman told the press, I feel like the moon, the stars, and all the planets just fell on me, which is a highly ironic statement coming from the four-year anniversary of what happened in Cape Girardeau, a town he knew fairly well. In 2005, so many people started chiming in on online forums with their own family narratives of how they had been told long ago by an FBI agent, a Marine guard, a nurse, the Secret Service, someone in their family had been told by various sources the same story, that Franklin Roosevelt pulled out a gun and ended his own life, and that they had to go with the story of a cerebral hemorrhage, which was technically true.
Leaving out the bullet.
Right.
Was there any clue from Eleanor Roosevelt, his wife?
I did not find any. However, it's very interesting to note, she arrived around midnight, took a plane from Washington, D.C. down to Warm Springs, and immediately ordered the president's casket closed to everyone. Not even family members were allowed to see the president's body. morticians had wrapped a bandage around his forehead, which is very strange considering the fact that he had died of so-called natural causes. The casket was closed, and it was taken to Washington on a train, and in D.C., not any family or friends were allowed to view the body at any time. The casket was kept closed in the White House and at Hyde Park, and he was buried promptly without anyone inspecting. And all medical notes and almost every bit of health information was supposedly lost. In other words, kept from the public, maybe destroyed.
Wow, that's riveting.
Yeah, it really is something, a new lens to look at our history. And remember that about that same time when Forrestal was appointed the first Secretary of Defense by Truman, mm-hmm. and he had not been Secretary of Defense very long, a couple of years, and he went out the glass window in the Bethesda, Maryland hospital where he had been, I guess, the family, the administration, who knows who got him into that hospital. But there is something I can share without naming names that I've always wondered about. This goes back, oh, probably 20 years ago. I talked with a man who was married in the Forrestal family. And he said that one of the family secrets was that when Secretary of Defense Forrestal was hospitalized, that the family was talking among themselves, and he had heard this discussion, as he was telling me. He was a mathematician in a university back east. He said that Forrestal told them that something with a glowing face was coming in his room. And they thought that that meant that the Secretary of Defense was losing his mind in history. And that's why this man told me, he said, what if some of these men who were trying to ride this very difficult extraterrestrial alien presence were actually having interactions in their rooms with something from outer space, but there was no context at all for discussion, and that Forrestal may literally have been dealing with something physically, and he was presumed to be losing his mind. And then the question was, did he commit suicide by jumping out of that hospital, or was he pushed? And that is something that will probably never be resolved, but it raises this big question. Those men who were trying to deal with the Nazis, World War II, the presence of UFOs, ETs, and keeping it all secret, my God, it must have been something mentally and emotionally.
For all of them.
Yeah.
For all of them.
And I've got a quote in 1954, July 11th, from the UK's Air Chief Marshal Lord Dowding of the Royal Air Force Fighter Command, and he said, quote, I am convinced that these objects do exist and that they are not manufactured by any nation on Earth. So there were military people all over the place dealing with this who kept dropping hints, this is from outer space.
And whatever happened then, it continued over our missile silos. Linda will have that part of the story next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us. Linda, these missile site sightings are probably some of the strangest, most intriguing cases I've ever heard of.
And really some of the hardest evidence of high strangeness in the world.
Yes.
They always have been. And whatever the truth about alien agendas on this planet, it's by the decades of the 1960s to 1970s that there was a sharp rise in UFO sightings and interactions with military and nuclear missile sites. One machinist that I'll call Dennis Smith to honor his request for anonymity was in the 8th Air Force, 450th Bomb Wing at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota. He was stunned when UFOs began interacting in 1964 onward in and around their big air base. The most chilling event was the melting shut, and I'm not kidding, the melting shut of a Minuteman missile silo's lid by a UFO emitting a nearly transparent beam, but it was seen by military eyewitnesses. Afterward, the missile crew 80 feet underground was sealed in their underground Minuteman silo. Here now to share his firsthand 1964 UFO experiences at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota is Dennis Smith.
It started out with what the UFOs were doing over our bomb dumps. It's directly above the main runway, and we have a huge one because of B-52s. It's mid-morning, clear, sunny, midsummer, July 1964. The thing is like a flare up there hanging in the sky. And two of our frontline fighter jets, F-106s, scrambled. And suddenly this thing squirted straight up. One pilot told me that he had it on his onboard radar, which is within 5 miles. So who knows how close he was to it until it just suddenly went straight up. Just there it is, and then suddenly it's at another altitude. I mean, just instantly with no means of propulsion. It's just there.
Were you ever able to talk with those pilots?
I did when they returned because I was out on the tarmac. They were mentally and physically shot. They were about ready to fall down. You can imagine the emotional drain. Then after that, the air police gathered all of us up, and we were herded into a meeting room. The base commander, he said, this is a blanket order to every one of you. We'll never talk about this. He handed a form, and you will sign it. You will never in your life talk about this.
And in that room, was anybody allowed to ask any questions?
No.
On the form that you had to sign, did it say anything specific about how they were trying to explain this altitude hopping object?
The form always stated that there were certain elements of happenings and things that you saw and that you would never talk about them. Driving on highway south of base to town, traffic stopped. Now, this was also in 64. This was more toward fall.
Okay, fall 64.
I know we got out of our cars and we looked, and there was a UFO to the west.
What did it look like?
Bright blob.
Daylight or night?
This was in the middle of the afternoon. We got close to town. You cross a river, and there are all kinds of fishermen standing on the bridge, all excited and jumping up and down and pointing, and they're pointing to the west. So four of us went west, including a cop. He picked up on this, and he went with us. And just a little ways out of town, there was a couple of other cars had pulled in there at a entry to a wheat field. And there were about 15 feet inside the open gate were four little pad marks in the field. And out in the center of those was a circular, like these crop circles, flattened out area.
And the circle is equidistant from four pad marks?
Yes, it's in the center of the pad marks.
And are the pad marks round, triangular, rectangular?
They were round, and they weren't very large. They were only maybe 4 inches.
What was the distance between the downed circle and each of the pad marks?
I'm estimating about 4 feet. So from the edge of that circular thing out to a pad would be about 4 feet also.
Yeah, so the whole thing would be about 12 feet in diameter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was it. There was no burn marks. There's no nothing.
If you guys were watching this bright thing in the sky, is it possible that this small unit was like an android today, came from the big bright object in the sky down?
Yeah. I thought this was a little robot thing that came out of the thing that we watched coming to town. Fast forward to the story, I'm in the machine shop. This young man called me out. I'm like, sure, I'll meet you down at the shop. What do you need? I need a wedge. Okay. How big of a wedge? I need a 36 by 17, and here's the angle of it. My gosh, man, that'll take me hours to machine that. He said, well, that crew's been in there for four different cycles. I says, can you tell me anything? No. Okay. I went up, got a hunk of steel out of the Army Corps of Engineers. I started machining that thing.
How big?
Inches. It's a pretty good sized wedge I'm machining out. But it had such an angle on it, I had to remove a lot of steel. So I'm carving away on it. He kept coming back, and he's just antsy's all get out. And finally, he says, okay, I'll tell you what it is. These airmen are trapped in a silo way up by the Canadian border. And we're going to take a helicopter right up there to get them out. Take your toolbox. So we went up there, and the story was that there were witnesses that saw this door get fused. And he figured out that if he drove this wedge in with a portable hydraulic unit, that he could break that loose and get it to swivel around and get those guys out of there.
Now, tell me what the eyewitnesses said about the fusing.
They didn't call it a ray because it was near invisible. After this thing hovered for about 1 minute, the door would not function.
Okay, and did they describe what it was that was hovering that emitted the ray?
Another one of these crafts, like I've said, a circular. All of these seemed to be up in that area. They had a slight belly on the bottom, a slight upwards form at the top, and then a very slight raise up above that yet in the center.
Okay, these were solid white lights or silver sun-like reflection.
Yes.
And all of them that you have firsthand knowledge about were round with slight bulges up above and below?
Yes.
And that in this case, did anybody ask, what were these men doing in this particular silo that would have merited a craft from outer space?
Exactly. It was just a common Minuteman missile. Boeing made that Minuteman, didn't they?
Right.
So I'm assuming he was a Boeing employee.
Well, he could have been working for the CIA, NSA, DIA. What happened when they tried to use the wedge that you had made to get those men out? What did the men say upon rescue?
Nothing. They were like they were in shell shock.
They're 80 feet down.
Yep.
Again, electromagnetic interference by the UFO. And so this guy that you built this wedge for, he applies it and it works. Who was there firsthand that you've talked to who saw the men when they came out?
I didn't talk to anybody. I just stood there and watched them come out, and they were zombies.
Okay, so you got to see them come out with your own eyes there at the site?
Yes.
They came out like zombies?
Yes.
Can you explain what that means?
It's like they were numb. And I don't think they did any talking at all. I don't think they spoke a word.
And you never heard anybody talk about it again? Like, did you know what happened to Joe Smith or John whatever?
Nope. It was never talked about again. One of my early trainers, he was on the spot investigator that went out to the crash there in
Roswell.
Yeah. He was one of them that went out there as an investigator. He said there were bodies out there.
Right? And did he use the word extraterrestrial?
Yeah.
Okay, and when he told you they were extraterrestrial bodies, how did he describe them?
They were all dead. He was disappointed in that. And they ran that machine by thought process, and it wasn't very big, and it wasn't damaged that much, and it was taken to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and it's still there.
What shape?
Circular. He said the people that went in it got sick.
The people who went in got sick because?
He didn't say. He said they just became violently ill.
How big in diameter did he estimate was the round part he could see?
About 15 feet. But then again, remember, he was out there at night, and they had those Army floodlights that were glaring and everything else.
How many dead bodies did he know about?
He saw two, but they told him there was one more.
For a total of three.
That's what he said.
And did one or all three of the bodies go to Wright-Patterson along with this extraterrestrial craft?
That's what he said.
Now, 2 years after the U.S. Air Force machinist Dennis Smith had these experiences at Minot Air Force Base, on August 24th to 25th, 1966, again, Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota, the UFO organization NICAP reported, quote, Minuteman site jammed by UFO. A United States missile program supervisor claims that mysterious, unidentified flying objects have seriously imperiled national security. Raymond Fowler, project supervisor on a Minuteman missile program near Boston, asserts that UFOs have penetrated the restricted airspace above America's missile sites, jamming vital electronic equipment. He also says the objects eluded fighter aircraft scrambled to intercept them. He says that he talked with an Air Force officer who had been in one of the subterranean launch control facilities of a North Dakota Minuteman site on August 25, 1966, when radar operators picked up a UFO maneuvering over the base at 100,000 feet. The officer declared that the launch control facility's sophisticated radio equipment that enables it to receive firing instructions from coordinating centers and transmit them to silo launch facilities was blocked. They were blocked out by static when the UFO hovered directly over it. Mr. Fowler recalls the officer saying that he could conceive of nothing on Earth that could cause the equipment to malfunction from such an altitude, emphasizing that it was working perfectly before the object appeared overhead and after it left, quote. Later on, the Minot Daily News had this headline, Minot Launch Control Center saucer cited as one indication of outer space visitors. You know, George, it's amazing as you go through the history how all of us had no idea that these kinds of local headlines or these events were taking place in the 1960s in our extremely sensitive Minuteman missiles.
They would have been lead stories all over the place.
Yeah, if all of us had known, and it's amazing what has trickled out over the last decades. And here's another one on the next year, March 5th, 1967. Again, Minot Air Force Base. Air Defense Command radar tracked an unidentified target descending over the Minuteman missile silos of the 91st Strategic Missile Wing at Minot. Base security teams quickly converged on the area and saw a metallic disc-shaped craft ringed with bright flashing lights moving slowly. The disc stopped and hovered about 500 feet off the ground as security police held their fire and watched in awe. Suddenly, the object began moving again and circled directly over the launch control facility. F-106 fighter interceptors were standing by on the flight line waiting for an order from NORAD to scramble. When the order was not forthcoming, Minot Air Force Base operations decided on their own to scramble the interceptors. At that exact moment, the UFO climbed straight up and streaked away at incredible speed, which is what Dennis Smith was observing himself in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
And then 1 year after that, in 1968, southwest of Minot, a military policeman received a call to one of the missile silos. The sergeant on duty and two other men traveled to where a UFO was hovering over a missile silo. They found the gate and the gate locks to the missile silo were open. The guards were reported to be motionless, like statues, as if their bodies were under something else's control. The sergeant contacted officers down in the silo who were very upset. The officers said the missile had become, and this is a quote, armed and unlocked in launch mode with an armed warhead.
Wow.
Close quote.
Dangerous.
Well, I mean, we're talking about the ability for UFOs, ETs, alien technology from someplace else that, as Bob Salas says, who had his own dramatic experiences at Malmstrom, we're dealing with an intelligence that is trying to make it clear they don't want nuclear missiles to be launched, and they're apparently trying to demonstrate that they are going to stop any efforts, and they're going to show us that they can either pull offline all of the missiles like they did at Malmstrom, or that they can manipulate from 100,000 feet or 1,000 feet or wherever they are. They can literally take control of these Boeing-made Minuteman missiles 80 feet underground and do so in a way that I interviewed, 15 years ago. It was a Boeing engineer, and he was specifically called in on the Bob Salas case at Great Falls. And he told me, he said, I know how these missiles are wired. I understand what's going on underground. And there was no possibility that anything that we made could have been brought down a few seconds apart as they were with Bob Salas, 10 missiles. He said it was not possible. So he said it means that whatever these UFOs are, whatever is inside them, they have the ability to electromagnetically interfere with missiles and take control in means that we could not have produced with wires on the ground or underground. And that is a sobering thought. But as Bob Salas said to me once, if the non-humans are concerned about our human civilization throwing nuclear weapons at each other and destroying the atmosphere and destroying the planet, maybe they are actually operating in a positive way if we knew the whole big picture, and they're trying to keep humans from destroying the planet.
What's your take on this? What do you think they want?
Well, I think that we have a mixed bag of agendas. That Reagan administration briefing that I've referenced in prior coasts, where they break down five different non-human groups, they tell Reagan that the top dog are the Ebens, the ones with the pear-shaped heads, and that they've made at least two of the next non-humans on the list. In other words, clones.
Hold on, Linda. We're at the top. We'll come back to that question. And it's time for phone calls, conversations with Linda.